I'm Michael Bryden, and this is part one of a two-part All the Best special on grief. We put a call out for submissions on the topic, and we were flooded. Grief, loss, death. It's all fascinating, and I don't really know why. Well, actually, I do.
So they've got a very unique sound, and some say you either love them or you hate them, but people tell me when I'm playing them about, particularly at funerals, they become very emotional. My name is Donald Blair. I am pipe major of the Warrnambool Pipe Band, and I'm a retired dairy farmer.
And you played pipes at my granddad's funeral?
Yes, I did.
My grandfather played the bagpipes. And when he died, I never really registered it. I was sad, sure, but that was it. Until Donald started playing the pipes at his funeral. And that first note, I was gone. I was a complete mess. Uncontrollable crying, wind knocked out of me. I could hardly walk straight. It was like this music had pierced through me. It made me extremely sad. So sad that I knew it was the sound. It had to be those pipes. I researched bagpipes and grief music and epigenetics and listened to more and more music from all over the world to try and see if anything else triggered the same response in me as the pipes did.
I often think when I go to funerals, if I just blew my pipes up and held one note, a lot of people would drop into tears. And I see people, the moment the pipes start up, I play quite often down from the front of the church out. And as I'm going out, I see people, before I started, they were just, you know, but then when the pipes start, you see the tears start to come down. So
you probably saw me like that.
probably. I had it put to me one time by a great pipe enthusiast and a great piper, Jimmy McPhee, who's not around now. But he said that when people take on musical instruments, there's certain vibes that those instruments coincide with the vibes in your body. In the case of you, subconsciously, there was something going in there. And also, you probably related, you could see your granddad and his pipes, maybe, when you heard the pipes going.
And that, what Donald said there, is what I think it really is. I got confused. I thought the music was making me sad. It wasn't. It wasn't that at all. It was me realizing that I'd never hear my grandfather play the bagpipes again. I'd never see my grandfather again. So I tried to see my grandfather and his pipes there, in the church. But I couldn't. I said that I knew why we're fascinated with grief, right? And I figured it out when Donald said that I wanted to see my grandfather playing those pipes. We're fascinated with grief because we don't know what happens next. When you lose someone, anyone, you look for a last fleeting connection that you might have with them before they're gone. And that's what Donald was doing for me when he played the pipes. Our next story is a fiction piece by Paul Della Rossa, published as part of Seizures Flashes Project and produced here for All the Best. Sometimes grief happens slowly. It comes with aging.
Mum had grown tired, so I tried flooding the basement. I put Mr. Zorro, her axolotl, into the water with her and she seemed happy. She'd float or paddle around the room in loose circles. When family came to visit, I'd tell them to take their shoes and socks off at the front door, and together we'd walk down the stairs, stopping just a few rungs before the water. Our ankles would get splashed as Mum came to meet us. When my niece and nephew slept over, I brought out a big orange pool noodle and let them swim with her. Michael, only 6, held on to the noodle and patted Mum's hair as she came close. Fiona giggled when Zorro swam near her heels. Mum started ignoring visitors. She just spent weeks bobbing up and down. When I asked her what was wrong, she answered me with my father's name. Nothing, Frank. One morning the water was red. I couldn't see her. I ran down the stairs and dived in. She was by the far corner, up against the dryer. A light fuzz enveloping her like down wisped away as my hands tried to grasp it. She had no cuts or bruises, and when I put my arms around her, she wriggled and glared. She was fine. Standing up, my dressing gown dripped heavy, its white stitching turned to salmon pink. A man from the council came out. He wore big plastic pants tucked into steel-toed gumboots and, standing in the kitchen, he told me we had a high concentration of phytoplankton, a red algal bloom. He nodded his head, trying to be nice about it. You could pump out all the water, put clean in, but within a month it would be back. Same thing happened down at the Marsh's place. The grandmother had even developed an infection. It'd have to be drained for good. I carried Mum upstairs and put her and Mr. Zorro in the bathtub. I set up the pump in the basement. Its little diesel motor made a putt-putt noise. The next morning I woke to the sound of thrashing. Water ran in rivulets down the tiles. Mum, her breathing ragged, let out a low moan as she smashed her body side to side. Her eyes were wild, and out of her lips poked a twitching leg and tail. Crying, I sat next to her, patting the side of her face until she calmed down. When she fell asleep, I walked downstairs and threw the pump against the wall. Outside, four carers wearing smocks and hairnets stood smoking. A yellow bucket sat on the asphalt next to them. It reeked of blood, fish guts, and raw meat. A carer hunched over, poured in bottle after bottle of multivitamin tablets. Michael tapped at the tank's glass, first with one finger, then two. An old man moved his head towards us, and then swam into the distance. Mum stayed floating, watching. I told Michael to wave hello.
That story from Paul Della Rossa. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and this week is part one of a two-part All the Best series on grief. This next story, My Mother Told Me by Selena Springett, looks at grief through the eyes of a child, and it may be upsetting for some listeners.
My mother told me when my sister was born, her waters broke while she was in the vegetable garden tending the cabbages. I was 5 years old when my sister died. Truth be told, I remember her more from the pictures on my mum's dresser than any actual memory of her. Me in pigtails, sitting in a green plastic baby bath with her in my lap. Her lying on a blanket on our old dining room table in the same white baby suit I had when I was a baby and that went on to become my son's. I still recall vividly the morning of her death. It was very early. I know this because the sky was that strange violet grey of pre-dawn. I think my father must have cried out because the next thing I remember was being in the lounge room next to my sister's crib. She had moved up and her head was touching the top edge. Next thing I remember was sitting on the front seat of our noisy yellow Renault, driving the few blocks from our house to the hospital. My mother was in the back wearing her pale blue short-sleeved dressing gown and trying in vain to resuscitate her baby. Thank you. hospital confusion reigned for me, and the last time I remember seeing my sister was when they put her on a hospital bed with an oxygen mask. It always struck me as strange that the bed they put her on was so big. Or maybe it was just because she was so small. I was ushered into an annex, and one of the nurses pressed a faded yellow bunny into my arms. I didn't cry at the funeral. I didn't really understand the magnitude. Only when I was older did I begin to understand why every year on the anniversary of her death, my mother quietly got herself drunk. I watched on with the self-obsessed curiosity of a five-year-old as people came and kissed the small white coffin in the church. My father didn't cry either when the coffin was lowered. But then boys aren't supposed to cry. And my father was always a man. Years later, when I was already an adult with children of my own, my mother told me how she had stomped on the cabbages in the vegetable garden. Why should they survive when my sister didn't?
Thanks to Selena Springett for sharing that story with us. Sound art by Stephen Vitiello.
When I'm gone, don't bury me. I will not lie under this town. I will not lie where I can't see. Please don't put me underground. If the day is sunny, let my father say some words. If the night is starry, let my mother tell you all her stories. Oh, my sister, bake a cake and on it she'll write something funny. Go down to the city square and give the artists all my money. as for all that is inside. You can give to medicine. And as for all my bones and hide, I'll just find a fire to put them in. If the day is sunny, let my father say some words. If the night is starry, let my mother tell you all her stories. Oh, my sister will bake a cake, and on it she'll write something funny. Go down to the city square and give the artist all my money.
This next story first aired on All the Best in 2012. How do you get to know someone when they're not around? Before social media, it was through sheer detective work, asking questions, looking at old photographs, reading anything they'd written or left behind. In the case of her mother, Madeline Cumming's own search led her to discoveries she could treasure forever.
My dad tells me that my mum danced like no one else. There's one video taken at my mum and dad's wedding that almost shows her dancing. The video pans towards the dance floor, and we see her, just for a moment. Her hands are raised into the air. She moves a little. When I first watched it, I was so excited with the expectation that I'd finally get to see her dance. But then the camera pans away, moves on to something else, which means that I'll never get to see her dance, because she died when I was 4 years old. When I was little, my mum and dad, like most parents in the 90s, took turns taking videos of me growing up. There were Christmas mornings, my first few birthdays. There was me riding my first plastic, feet-controlled bicycle. There was bath time and dancing time, and any other moment my parents thought was worthy of preservation. One video that I've watched over and over again shows my mum sitting on the couch in our old living room. She had cystic fibrosis, and it's not long after a double lung transplant. She's got an oxygen mask on, and she sings to me for a long time, trying to get me to dance. I think I'm around 2 or 3 years old, and I take turns running around, jumping up and hiding behind the couch so she can't see me. I was still young when she died, and when you're that young, you don't really appreciate your parents' distinctive, individual personalities. So in the years after she died, I didn't really miss her as a person, but I missed her as a mum, my mum, that comforting, hazy, abstract image of someone who was meant to be there, but now wasn't. It helped that I was constantly surrounded by a host of loving adults. My dad, Billy, successfully played the role of both parents. Then there was my extended family, who I visited overseas every year or so. And there were two strong, caring women in my life, Wendy and Jenny, who felt like grandmothers to me. All of these people made me feel the feelings you're supposed to feel when you're a kid. Safe, comfortable, and loved. I was young, content to live in my imagination, and a little bit oblivious to the world around me. It was only when I was 11 that I started to get a good idea of what kind of person my mum actually was. I found a duffel bag hidden away in a cupboard behind our front room couches. I asked my dad about it, and he swore and chuckled and told me that he was saving it for when I turned 18. I smiled, proud of myself for finding something that was meant to be kept secret. He said, "Well, you've found it now. You might as well open it." It was a black Triple M duffel bag full of treasure. I found her old glasses, big and thick in 80s style. I found a Jeffrey Archer book she'd been reading and realized my mum liked crime novels. I also found my parents' wedding rings. They were plain gold, sitting in a black velvet box. The size difference was the thing that got me. My mum's wedding ring was tiny in comparison to my dad's because of her disease. Besides the lung problems, people with cystic fibrosis don't digest food properly, so they're always pretty thin. Even though I was just 11, The ring would barely fit onto my pinky. The story of my parents' relationship, how they met and fell in love, has been told to me so many times it's burned into my memory. My dad was from Scotland, and my mum was from America, and they met on an old, dusty bus travelling to Uluru. They dated long distance at the beginning, and stayed in touch through letters and a weekly phone call, my dad saving his coins to call my mum from a phone box on his street. The picture that I have of my mum at this point, before I turned 17, are pieced together from stories of this relationship, their meeting, how they fell in love, the pranks they played, as well as videos, books dog-eared and tucked away on a shelf, bags hidden behind couches and in cupboards. One night when I was 17, I was sifting through a box that was filled to the brim with photographs. I'd looked through it before, numerous times actually. Most of the photos were of my mum and dad and their friends at parties and holidays. Others were of my cousins and me. There was such a huge quantity of photos, though, that I'd never actually made it to the bottom of the box. I'd always get lost at the beginning and never go any further. I think I was feeling particularly curious that night, so I started looking at the items underneath, pulling the photographs out and actually digging my way to the bottom. To the side of the box, pressed between some photographs I hadn't reached, was a surprisingly large amount of letters. They were still in their envelopes, their edges jagged from being opened, and on the front was my dad's name. I knew what I wanted them to be, but I wasn't sure yet. After opening the first letter, I realised that they were written by my mum to my dad when they were still dating long distance. I read them all in one night, sitting on my bed, glued to her handwritten words. They were all cute and really funny, and a lot are just of her rambling about her life and her studies and how she misses my dad. The letters were what I needed. Here she was, her personality written out to the person she cared about most. When I think about the anecdotes I've been told, the videos, the duffel bag, they're all valuable. They all give me a piece of her personality. But it's the letters that give me the biggest insight into who she was. She was just so hilarious and vibrant. And every time I read something laugh out loud funny, I'd read it out to my dad, and he'd laugh and say, well, she was a funny bugger. I have so many favourites. It's difficult to pick absolutes. There was the one where she pretended to be the headmistress of her college. She used official notepaper and wrote about her antics at a Christmas party through a fake headmistress's eyes. Elizabeth Ann Carroll was witnessed to have strutted around Knowlton Dormitory at the annual Christmas party half-naked. Miss Carroll proceeded to vainly socialise with college students with her dress unzipped. I wanted to bring this matter to your attention before you got too involved with this young lady. We feel she's gone too far. Sincerely, Anne Horton, headmistress. She also wrote half a letter to him drunk once. At the beginning, her writing is big and messy. She writes, well, the thing is, I'm a bit drunk right now. Wait, my pizza is done. And then she continues down the page. I'm eating pizza and drinking soda in order to reduce my drunk state before I go to bed. These words are rather long, aren't they? But all the better to see them with. This was her sense of humour, all written out, ready for me to read. She slowly revealed herself to me over the years, as funny, silly, a little crazy, completely unselfconscious, strong, and determined. She seemed to enjoy herself so much, maybe because she knew she wasn't going to be around for very long. It's hard not to compare myself to her, especially now. She met my dad at the age of 21, and I turned 21 recently. I can't say that I'm as funny as her. I'm also a little self-conscious, especially when I dance. I find it difficult to live in the present and appreciate what I have, particularly with certain all-important things like my health. Sometimes I wonder what it would have been like to have known her, what I missed out on. I try not to dwell on that too much, though. I feel like I've discovered who she was in a way that makes sense to me, and that's the only way I can imagine it.
Okay, Liz, you have to say goodbye and I'll fade out because we're getting a fair minute up. Okay, to you school. Bye.
Bye-bye. 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 Thank you.
Bye-bye, Madeline.
That piece was written and read by Madeline Cummings, produced by Qmin Lu, with original music by Jameson Shaw and technical production by Antonia Gauci.
This episode of All the Best was produced at Triple R in Melbourne, in association with FBI Radio in Sydney, SYN in Melbourne, and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Selena Springett and Paul Della Rossa. Next week in our two-part series on grief...
The grieving process is quite difficult. It doesn't end. You can't say, well, she's dead now, or he's dead now, and I've got to move on. It's... doesn't end.
Is grief a problem that humanity wants to get rid of and it makes us better as people? I'm not sure. I don't know. It's a big question.
And you'll meet my new co-host, Pip Rasmussen. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan, and I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
I hope in the final moments I hear every song I've ever sung. At once, when I'm gone, don't weep and mourn. 'Cause where I'm going, it's a pleasant stay. Visit my grandfather's home and drink gin with Billie Holiday. If the day is sunny.